A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one after a month of moving chaos, and it's basically a neurology puzzle wrapped in a Dremel tool. He says every day of the move was stop-start. Clamp an Ethernet cable. Baby needs attention. Find the box with the tape. Baby again, 50 micro-interruptions an hour. Then he picks up a Dremel to engrave a tool label. Boring, repetitive, requires concentration, and suddenly his brain goes quiet. His question is, why does focused labor feel like rest to an ADHD brain, while a day of fragmented unpacking feels like psychological torture? And if flow is what feeds his happiness, how do you carve it out when life won't stop interrupting?
The thing that makes this counterintuitive is that on paper, unpacking boxes sounds easier than engraving. Unpacking is low skill. You can do it half asleep. Engraving requires steady hands and sustained attention. So why does the easy thing wreck him and the demanding thing restore him? The answer is in what each task does to the prefrontal cortex and the dopamine system, and they're doing radically opposite things.
The moving days sound like they were basically a task switching assault course.
And for an ADHD brain, task switching isn't just annoying. It's metabolically expensive in a way it isn't for neurotypical brains. The baseline problem is dopamine. ADHD brains have lower tonic dopamine and fewer dopamine transporters in the prefrontal cortex. Dopamine is the neurotransmitter that lets you initiate and sustain attention on something. When you're low on it, engaging a task requires more neural effort. Your prefrontal cortex has to work harder just to get into gear. Now, every time you switch tasks, you're not just pivoting. You're actively inhibiting the previous task schema, disengaging from that neural network, and activating a new one. Each of those transitions requires a dopamine reset. If you're doing that 50 plus times an hour for a full day, you're depleting a system that was already running on a deficit.
It's like repeatedly restarting a car with a weak battery.
That's actually a solid analogy. Each restart costs more than it should, and eventually the battery just won't turn over. There's research from 2024 and 2025 that's quantified this pretty starkly. ADHD brains show 30 to 40% greater prefrontal cortex activation during task switching compared to neurotypical controls. 30 to 40% more metabolic cost per switch. That's not a small difference. That's a fundamentally different energy budget for the same day.
Which explains why Daniel described the moving days as exhausting, even though no single task was hard. It's not the weight of the boxes, it's the weight of the switches.
And there's a second layer to this, cortisol. Every interruption doesn't just cause dopamine, it triggers a microcortisol spike. Your brain registers the interruption as a minor stressor. Something pulled you away from an incomplete goal. Over a day of 50 plus interruptions, the cumulative cortisol load produces a state that mimics chronic stress. You end the day feeling wired and depleted at the same time. Achy, grumpy, on edge, which is exactly how Daniel described waking up.
He said he woke up on the wrong side of the bed, back aching, just grouchy. And he connected it to not having had flow state time for a month.
That connection is neurologically precise. He's describing what you could call flow debt. When an ADHD brain goes weeks without sustained flow states, the dopamine regulation system becomes progressively less efficient. The receptors get a bit downregulated because they're not getting those sustained periods of tonic dopamine release that flow provides. You end up in this paradoxical state of chronic understimulation masked by frantic overactivity. You're busy all day, but your brain is starving for the kind of engagement it actually needs.
Let's get into what's happening during the engraving. Because that's the part Daniel said most people wouldn't understand. Doing something that requires active concentration felt like rest.
Flow states are characterized by something called transient hypofrontality, reduced activity in the prefrontal cortex. Now, for an ADHD brain that's been in hypervigilant task switching mode for weeks, that downregulation is relief. The prefrontal cortex finally gets to stop frantically re-engaging every 30 seconds. It gets to quiet down. Meanwhile, the task itself, the repetitive motor cognitive loop of engraving, is providing just enough dopamine to keep you engaged without overstimulating the system. The sensory feedback of the tool biting into metal, the visible progress, the completion of each letter, those are all micro-rewards. They're releasing dopamine in a steady, regulated way, not in the spiky, novelty-chasing pattern that ADHD brains typically default to.
Daniel made an interesting distinction. He said he doesn't experience flow as euphoric, the way architects and artists often describe it. For him, it's more like quiet relief, the absence of mental noise rather than the presence of euphoria.
That distinction maps onto something real in the neurochemistry. Neurotypical flow often involves a dopamine surge paired with moderate hypofrontality. It can feel euphoric, time-dissolving, transcendent. But ADHD flow tends to involve dopamine regulation rather than a surge paired with deeper hypofrontality. The brain isn't getting high, it's finally getting enough. The default mode network, which is the brain network that generates mind wandering and distraction, shows about a 40% reduction in activity during flow states in ADHD brains. That's from a 2025 fMRI study at UC Davis. 40% less internal noise. For someone whose brain is normally a radio with six stations playing at once, that reduction feels like silence. And silence, when you've been starved of it, feels like peace.
The engraving isn't making him happy in the way a fun activity would. It's removing the thing that makes him unhappy. The noise.
And that's why the counterintuitive thing Daniel noticed about boring tasks actually checks out. He said engraving is boring, but because it's boring, it lets you drift into that meditative zone. That's not a bug, it's the mechanism. Mildly boring, repetitive tasks often work better for inducing ADHD flow than genuinely interesting or exciting tasks. Here's why. The ADHD brain has a novelty-seeking system that's constantly scanning for more stimulating inputs. If you're doing something exciting, setting up a new gaming PC, say, or starting a creative project, the novelty-seeking system stays active. It's pulling your attention toward new stimuli within the task, or toward other potential tasks. That can actually prevent flow by keeping the prefrontal cortex in a state of partial vigilance. But a mildly boring task like engraving or labeling or sorting, it doesn't trigger the novelty-seeking system at all. It's predictable, repetitive, and just engaging enough to anchor attention without overstimulating. So the prefrontal cortex can finally downregulate fully.
That's almost the opposite of what you'd intuit. You'd think the fun task would be more restorative.
That's the misconception most people have about ADHD and flow. They think it's about doing something you love. But for ADHD brains, the task characteristics that matter are repetitive fine motor engagement, clear immediate feedback, and low novelty. Love is optional. The engraving works because every stroke of the Dremel gives you a tiny completion signal. You see the letter appear. You feel the vibration change as you finish a line. Those microfeedback loops are what keep the dopamine flowing steadily, without spiking it.
Daniel also mentioned he's been engraving tools as part of an inventory system, something he started for practical reasons during years of moving. So there's a functional purpose, too. He's not just engraving for the sake of it.
Which adds another layer. Purposeful repetition, where the task has a tangible outcome you value, seems to enhance the regulatory effect. You're not just zoning out, you're producing something. The brain gets the dopamine from the motor feedback plus the dopamine from meaningful completion. It's a double hit of regulation.
Let's talk about what happens when you go without this for a month. Daniel said he's been deprived of flow states, and he's realized increasingly that they're what feed his happiness. That's a strong claim. He's basically saying flow is as essential as sleep or nutrition for his emotional regulation.
I think that's neurologically accurate for a lot of ADHD brains. There was a 2024 study in the Journal of Attention Disorders that looked at this directly. They had ADHD adults engage in 20-plus minutes of repetitive fine motor tasks, things like whittling, knitting, engraving, detailed sorting. They measured salivary cortisol before and after, and they tested attention performance on subsequent tasks. The results were measurable. Reduced cortisol, improved attention, and the effect wasn't subtle. We're talking statistically significant drops in stress biomarkers from a single 20-minute session. Now extrapolate that. If a single session produces measurable regulatory benefits, what happens when you go 4 weeks without any sessions at all? And like sleep debt, it compounds. The first few days without flow, your dopamine regulation system can compensate. After a week, you're running on stress hormones and willpower. After a month, you wake up achy and grouchy, and you don't even fully know why, because you've been busy every day. Your brain has been in a state of chronic understimulation masked by frantic overactivity. The moving chaos provided enough cortisol and adrenaline to keep you going, but it never provided the dopamine regulation your brain actually needed to recover.
That phrase, frantic overactivity masking understimulation, that describes a lot of modern life for a lot of people, not just those with ADHD.
And it's worth noting that the 2025 UC Davis study found something else interesting. A single flow session improved task switching performance for up to 90 minutes afterward. So it's not just that flow feels good in the moment. It actually makes you more resilient to the fragmentation that comes after. It's a pre-regulator. You do the flow first, and then the subsequent interruptions cost you less.
Which is the exact opposite of how most people structure their day. Most people try to get the fragmented stuff done first. The emails, the small tasks, the interruptions, and then hope to find flow later. But by the time later arrives, they're depleted.
And that's one of the most actionable insights from this research. If you know your day is going to be stop-start, parenting, moving, open office work, front-load 15 to 20 minutes of flow activity before the chaos begins, it pre-regulates your dopamine system. The task switches that follow will be less metabolically expensive. The cortisol spikes will be smaller. You're essentially putting on neural armor before walking into the fragmentation.
Daniel's experience also raises a question about what we consider rest. He said he doesn't experience engraving his work at all. It's a wonderful state where, because he's focusing, his mind is able to relax. That flips the standard model of rest versus labor completely upside down.
And it points to a fundamental misunderstanding in how we think about cognitive rest. For most people, rest means doing nothing, lying on the couch, scrolling your phone, watching TV. But for an ADHD brain, doing nothing often means the default mode network kicks into high gear. Mind wandering, rumination, internal noise. That's not restful, it's just a different kind of cognitive load. What Daniel's describing is that focused engagement, particularly focused physical engagement, quiets the default mode network. That 40% reduction we mentioned. So the brain is actually doing less work during focused engraving than it is during passive rest.
The couch is louder than the Dremel.
That's a perfect way to put it. The couch is louder than the Dremel. And that's why so many ADHD people find themselves gravitating toward what look like work activities when they're stressed. They sharpen knives. They organize drawers. They fold laundry obsessively. It looks like they're being productive, but what they're actually doing is self-medicating with flow.
Daniel asked for diagnostics, and I think we've laid those out. But he also asked for practical strategies. If you're struggling to find periods of flow because life is fragmented, parenting a one-year-old, moving apartments, working, how do you carve it out?
The first strategy is what I'd call identifying your anchor tasks. These are the specific, repetitive, mildly boring physical tasks that reliably produce flow for you. For Daniel, it's engraving. For someone else, it might be folding laundry, sharpening knives, sorting Lego, hand-washing dishes, whittling, knitting, tracing patterns. The key criteria requires fine motor engagement, has clear immediate feedback loops, and is boring enough not to trigger novelty seeking. Everyone's anchor task will be different, but the characteristics are consistent. You know you found one when 20 minutes disappears and you feel calmer at the end than when you started.
I'd add that the boring part is crucial, and it's the part people get wrong. They think they should find a hobby they love, but a hobby you love might be too stimulating. The anchor task should be almost tedious, but tedious in a way that feels good.
The second strategy is scheduling flow before fragmentation. If you know your day is going to be chaotic, get up 20 minutes earlier and do your anchor task before anyone else is awake. It feels counterintuitive. You're already tired. Why add a task? But it's not adding a task. It's adding a regulator. And the UC Davis data shows it improves your resilience to the fragmentation that follows for up to 90 minutes. So that 20-minute investment pays back in reduced stress across the next hour and a half of chaos.
What if you can't get 20 minutes? Daniel's situation with a one-year-old. Sometimes you can't even get 5.
That's where the third strategy comes in, flow snacks. These are 2 to 3 minute microdoses of repetitive motor engagement, sharpening a pencil, organizing 3 items on your desk, tracing a pattern with your finger, folding 1 shirt perfectly. They don't produce deep flow, but they can interrupt the cortisol accumulation of constant task switching. It's like a pressure release valve. You're not getting the full restorative effect, but you're preventing the system from overheating entirely. Over a day of 50 interruptions, 5 or 6 flow snacks can be the difference between ending the day frazzled and ending the day functional.
The pencil sharpening thing is interesting. It's almost ritualistic. A tiny moment of order in the chaos.
That's exactly what the brain needs. A tiny moment where the motor cognitive loop closes cleanly. You start, you do, you finish. The feedback is immediate and unambiguous. The pencil is sharp. The brain gets its microdose of completion dopamine, and you can face the next interruption with a slightly less depleted system.
The fourth thing Daniel's experience points to is recognizing flow debt. He said he woke up grumpy and achy and realized he hadn't had flow time in a month. That self-awareness that took him a month to arrive at. Most people would just think they're tired or stressed or need a vacation.
That's the actionable piece. If you're feeling inexplicably irritable, achy, or emotionally fragile, check when you last had a flow state. If it's been more than 3 or 4 days, you're probably in flow debt. Treat it like sleep debt. It needs to be repaid, not pushed through. You can't willpower your way out of dopamine depletion any more than you can willpower your way out of exhaustion. The only fix is to do the thing that regulates the system.
There's an architectural dimension here too, which Daniel touched on. He mentioned architects have described flow states, but their description didn't fully match his experience. They talk about euphoria and time dissolving. He talked about quiet relief.
That's a really useful distinction. The architectural or artistic flow experience, what you might call classic, Csikszentmihalyi flow, often involves a balance of high challenge and high skill, and it produces a kind of transcendent absorption. The self disappears. It can feel euphoric, but what Daniel's describing is closer to what you might call regulatory flow. The challenge is low to moderate. The skill is moderate. The experience isn't transcendent, it's grounding. The self doesn't disappear, but the noise around the self quiets down. And for ADHD brains, regulatory flow may actually be more restorative than peak flow, because it doesn't involve the noradrenaline spike that comes with high challenge activities.
Hyperfocus versus flow. That's a distinction worth making. People confuse them.
They do, and they're different neurochemical states. Hyperfocus is often involuntary. The brain locks onto something and can't disengage. It's driven by noradrenaline and can be exhausting even though it feels productive in the moment. You come out of hyperfocus drained. Flow, especially the regulatory flow Daniel's describing, is balanced dopamine plus endocannabinoid release. You come out of it restored. The difference is measurable in how you feel afterward. Hyperfocus leaves you depleted. Flow leaves you regulated.
Daniel said something that stuck with me. He said the part of moving that was exhausting wasn't the physical labor or the uncertainty. It was that it was so stop and start. The fragmentation itself was the stressor.
That's the insight that ties all of this together. The most exhausting thing about modern life for ADHD brains isn't the volume of tasks. It's the fragmentation of attention. 50 microtransitions an hour, every hour, for weeks. The brain never gets to complete a single motor cognitive loop without interruption. It's like trying to breathe in an environment where someone taps you on the shoulder every time you start to inhale. You never get a full breath.
The engraving is a full breath.
The engraving is a full breath, a complete inhale and exhale of attention. Start, sustain, complete. Over and over, each letter a full cycle. The brain finally gets to do what it's been trying to do for a month, finish something.
Daniel also asks what a flow-first approach to daily life would look like. If flow is a neurological necessity, not a luxury, how do we redesign around it?
That's the open question worth sitting with. Right now, most people's days are designed around task completion. The to-do list dictates the structure. A flow-first approach would design around regulation instead. You'd ask not what needs to get done today, but when will I get my flow window, and how do I protect it? The flow window becomes the non-negotiable, and the tasks fit around it. For parents, that might mean trading off with a partner for 20 minutes of protected time. For workers, it might mean blocking the first 20 minutes of the day as flow time before opening email. The specifics vary, but the principle is the same. Flow isn't the reward you get after everything else is done. It's the foundation that makes everything else possible.
He also mentioned that the engraving serves a practical purpose. the inventory system. So there's a double benefit. He's regulating his brain and producing something useful.
That's the ideal. The most sustainable anchor tasks are the ones that produce something you value. It's harder to justify 20 minutes of whittling if the whittling feels purposeless. But if you're engraving tools you'll use, or folding laundry your family will wear, or sharpening knives you'll cook with, the task carries its own justification. You're not taking time away from life. You're doing life in a way that also regulates your brain.
Daniel's prompt is basically a case study in something a lot of people feel but can't articulate. The busy day that leaves you drained for reasons you can't name. The boring task that feels like a sanctuary. The realization that your brain needs something specific and isn't getting it.
The diagnostics are clear. Task switching depletes dopamine and spikes cortisol. Flow replenishes dopamine and quiets the default mode network. For ADHD brains, these effects are amplified. The depletion is steeper, the replenishment is more essential. A month without flow isn't just unpleasant. It's a neurochemical deficit that produces real symptoms, irritability, achiness, emotional fragility. The fix isn't rest in the passive sense. It's engagement in the focus sense. The Dremel isn't work, it's medicine.
If someone listening recognizes themselves in this, they've been fragmented for weeks, they're grumpy and achy and can't figure out why, the first step is to identify their anchor task. The thing that's mildly boring, repetitive, involves their hands, and makes them feel calmer after 20 minutes. And then protect 20 minutes for it, ideally before the chaos starts.
If 20 minutes isn't possible, take the flow snacks. 2 minutes of sharpening a pencil. 3 minutes of organizing a drawer. Don't let the perfect be the enemy of the good. A micro dose of regulation is better than none.
The bigger question Daniel's experience raises is whether we're designing our environments all wrong for ADHD brains. Open offices, constant notifications, parenting in the age of infinite interruption. We've built a world that maximizes task switching and minimizes flow. And then we wonder why everyone's exhausted.
That's the architectural question, really. Not just the architecture of buildings, but the architecture of daily life. If flow is a neurological necessity for a significant portion of the population, what would it mean to build flow breaks into schedules the way we build in meal breaks? What would a school day look like if it included 20 minutes of repetitive motor flow between subjects? What would a workplace look like if it protected flow windows the way it protects meeting times?
Daniel's Dremel might be the canary in the coal mine, a small, buzzing signal that the way we're living is starving our brains of something essential.
The solution isn't complicated. It's just counterintuitive. Do the boring thing with your hands. Do it for 20 minutes. Do it before the chaos starts. Your brain will thank you in neurotransmitters.
Now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
In the 1910s, Japanese colonists in the Kuril Islands popularized a diamond-shaped tiling pattern for drying seaweed that unexpectedly turned out to be mathematically optimal for maximizing surface area per square meter of rack space, a geometric efficiency that was only formally proven in 2014.
Seaweed optimization geometry?
I have so many questions about the research methodology there.
This has been My Weird Prompts. Thanks to our producer, Hilbert Flumingtop. If this episode helped you understand your brain a little better, leave a review. It helps other people find the show. And if you've got a weird prompt about your own brain, send it in. We might unpack it in a future episode. I'm Korn.
I'm Herman Poppleberry. Go find your anchor task.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The hosts dig in, the hosts dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.